without a break. We're going on to multi-wavelength light curve modeling, one of three sessions. Our first speaker is Marcus Fletcher.
Okay.
Marcus, you have 30 minutes. I'll let you know when you have 5 minutes left, or 10 minutes left, so you can have some time for questions.
Thank you. Yeah, so I've been asked to give a general overview of issues in modeling spectral energy distributions and variability of blazars. Especially the first half of my talk will be really a general overview that kind of sets the stage for more specific talks later in this conference. So the basic idea of blazar models, those of you who have been at the Fermi-Mead's Jansky meeting last year might have seen quite a bit of this last year. But blazar SEDs are generally modeled by individual emission regions moving down this road of jets, Lorentz factors to maybe about 10 or so as measured by the LBI measurements. Typically, one assumes some power law distribution injected in electrons. There's going to be some escape and cooling going on. So certainly, if you don't need a simple power law distribution, probably you've got a cooling break somehow. Synchrotron emission makes up the lower energy part of the SED. Compton emission in leptonic models makes up the gamma rays. Compton emission can either result from upscattering intrinsic synchrotron radiation, or there can be quite a variety of external photon sources depending on where exactly the gamma ray emission region is, which of course is a matter of a huge debate. So, for example, the earliest suggestion probably was by Dermer and Schlickeiser that this might be just direct accretion disk emission, which enters the blob and this emission region and gets bumped and upscattered. It might be reprocessed emission from the broad line region. So if the emission region is within less than a parsec, so then that might make a substantial contribution. Otherwise, if the emission region is further out, we might get a substantial contribution from infrared emission, from a dust torus, a dusty material, might not be actually torus. So if this is much more than parsec scales, then the infrared external radiation fields might play an important role. Of course, we probably don't have just one emission region. There might be several. The jets might be slowing down as they go. So you might have radiative interaction between different emission regions. A scenario originally proposed, I think, by Nirmanopoulos and Kazanas, 2003. That's actually one idea that might overcome some of the old problems with required extreme Doppler boosting factors. If you have synchrotron radiation from different emission regions being Doppler boosted towards each other by relative motion. Or another possibility is that we have a layered jet spine sheath model where we have synchrotron emission from a slower outer sheath interacting with a fast, highly relativistic inner spine, and those two components interact radiatively by common scattering. So, just quick overview of blazar classifications. So we're coming to how to interpret different kinds of blazars along this blazar sequence. Of course, tomorrow, Eileen Meyer is going to tell us that this is actually all wrong. But to first approximation, I think this is still a reasonable guide for classifying different classes of blazars, just essentially by the location of the synchrotron peak. We distinguish between the low synchrotron peak blazars with synchrotron peaks below 10 to 14 hertz, high frequency peak blazars above 10 to 15 hertz, and objects in between these intermediate peak blazars. And at least when this was first discussed by Fossati et al. 98, it was found that these low synchrotron peak blazars tend to be more gamma ray dominated than the high synchrotron peak blazars. Although we see that line actually is more and more blurred. We have actually few examples of even high synchrotron peak blazars that are occasionally in gamma ray flares, gamma ray dominated. You see here this intermediate peak blazar 3C66A, the A should probably be down there. That is actually, even though it's very close in synchrotron peak frequency to the high frequency peak blazars, it's actually strongly gamma ray dominated. So this part of this blazar sequence is definitely not as strict as it used to be. if we apply electronic blazar models to these different types of blazars. So for a long time, it seemed to work pretty well, assuming that these high-frequency peaked BLAC objects were very well fit by standard synchrotron self-Compton models, so synchrotron in the low-energy regime, synchrotron self-Compton in the high-energy regime. One needed some typical parameters as given here, low magnetic fields, very high electron Lorentz factors. But here the classical picture, because as most of you might know, it's very rapid variability that's been seen in some blazars from occurring quite over 2155 minus 204. Creates substantial problems to this very simple implementation. On the other end of the blazar sequence, typically it's been mentioned before, we need, in addition to synchrotron, also external Compton components, synchrotron, synchrotron self-Compton, and external Compton components to make up the gamma rays. Typically, we need higher magnetic fields, a Gauss or a few Gauss or so, and lower electron energies. Now, intermediate between these two, it turned out, especially from recent discoveries of very high energy gamma rays from some intermediate and even low frequency big BLAC objects. These are two recent Veritas discoveries of intermediate BLAC objects. And for those, we find consistently that even there, we need external Compton components. So even though in the synchrotron peak, they're pretty close to these classical high-frequency BLAC objects, a little bit lower frequency, we already need quite substantial external Compton components. So we try to fit these as well with synchrotron self-Compton, especially in 3C66A, even the spectral shape is difficult to reproduce. In WCOME as well, we have Argile upper limits that would be violated if we fit SSC. In addition to that, you would need very low magnetic fields, far below equipartition, means the energy content in the jet would be strongly dominated by the particles, which would make jet confinement actually quite problematic. This all can be overcome if we allow for some infrared external radiation field, so some dusty material, some warm dust in the near nuclear region, which might also indicate that this is enough. If there is a weak broad line region, it's probably very small, way less than parsec scale, so this might be happening on the parsec, maybe 10 parsec scale. Sure. Yeah, it's not long on that. Okay. So the alternative class of blazar models involves hadrons, involves relativistic protons that might also make a contribution to the high energy emission. So overall, so there's here some of the seminal works that develop these kinds of models. Then, of course, we still have electrons that make up the low energy part of the SED with electron synchrotron radiation. But in these models, it's assumed that we also have relativistic, ultra relativistic protons that can make a substantial radiated contribution to synchrotrons, electron synchrotron at low energies. The high energies would then be dominated if the protons have high enough energy by either proton synchrotron emission or proton interacting with photopion production mechanisms, either directly pi zero production, pi zeros decaying to gamma rays, or charged pion productions and then decay to muons and electrons and positrons that would produce synchrotron radiation and produce gamma rays at the highest energies. These gamma rays produced by pions, muons, secondary electrons, positrons, typically emanate at very high energies where the emission region is highly opaque to gamma-gamma absorption, so these have to cascade down to optically thin, gamma-gamma optically thin frequencies where they can emerge. In order for these models to work, typically, so if we want these protons to overcome the photopion production thresholds, we need energies that they interact with optical photons of about an eV, then we need protons with energies about 7 × 10⁶ electron volt. Then if we want proton synchrotron emission to contribute at the highest gamma ray energies, in fact, we need this to extend up to about 10⁻⁹ electron volt. which of course motivates the assumption that maybe these might be the sources of ultra high energy cosmic rays. Now, and of course, we also want the Larmor radii of these ultra relativistic protons to be within the emission region, which is constrained by variability time scales. So that means we typically need magnetic fields over 10, or one uses 30 or 100 Gauss of this order. Synchrotron cooling time scales of the protons, even in these large magnetic fields, is still typically about several days, even accounting for a Doppler contraction. So that means variability, very fast variability, minute time scale variability would be extremely difficult to explain unless maybe one has some weird geometrical effects that might still help. We can, not surprising, of course, also fit most blazar SEDs with these hadronic models or leptohadronic models, because it's a mix of leptons and hadrons that are involved. Here's prototype BLAC, where the red curve is a leptonic model fit. The green curve involves protons, where we have the gamma rays, the Fermi gamma rays, dominated here by proton synchrotron, and then we have secondaries from photopion production filling up the X-rays here and extending the gamma ray spectrum out to very high energies. So if we have a strongly peaked gamma ray spectrum, that is often easily achievable by proton synchrotron emission, and if we have cascades contributing, that allows us to extend spectra out to very high energies. But it inevitably, just because of this cascading process, fills up the X-rays. That's intermediate BLAC, B66A, which we've seen the leptonic fit before. Hadronic model can do just as good a job in this. And for HBLs, these models typically work pretty well. So now, we said before, discussing these leptonic models, that the HBL type-specific BLAC objects could typically be fit very well with simple synchrotron-synchrotron self-Compton. Now, recently we had a couple of new discoveries of very high-energy gamma-ray blazars by Veritas, and we found two of them, high-frequency BLAC objects, where SSC, in fact, just from very general considerations and also just from chi-square considerations, are really disfavored. So this is one of them, paper that's probably going to appear in FJ in the next 2 or 3 weeks. RxJ0648 is close to the galactic anti-center. We can see overall the pure synchrotron self-Compton. We get a reasonable fit to here optical UV X-ray data, but we only have upper limits, or mostly have upper limits here in the Fermi regime, which are clearly violated by a pure SSC fit. This LB over LE is essentially the fraction of equipartition, the total energy content and magnetic field over energy content in the electrons. That is reasonably close to equipartition, but simply the over-predicting the Fermi flux seems to be a serious problem. If we allow for some external radiation field infrared, as we have done for these IBLs, 366A and WCOME, we, in fact, overcome this problem. We are consistent with all these upper limits here, and we still get a nice fit through the Veritas data points. A hadronic fit can do just as good a job, where we have the gamma ray strongly dominated here simply by proton signature. And you can see in this case, quite often, hadronic models require very extreme powers in the relativistic protons. In this case, 2 × 10⁻⁷ Earths per second is actually quite a modest requirement compared to some cases, 3C279, where we had done something similar. Thomas flashed that summary slide for a second, so where we thought that we would need some 10⁻⁴9 Earths per second or so to come to a better fit than leptonic models, which we had shown work with Alan Marsher and Anita Reimer, that leptonic models in general have a serious problem with this SC279 being fueled to the magic detection. The second object where we found something very similar is RBS0413. That paper is done in preparation, probably going to come out next year, hopefully very soon, where we can then produce an SFC synchrotron here. We add a host galaxy contribution here. This is already not a pretty nice fit. And while the Fermi flux in general is not too much of a problem, see that the spectral index that we have to produce with SFC to be consistent with these fluxes clearly is too steep compared to what Fermi actually measures. Again, we get a much better fit there. We use external Compton and additional problem here was that we are more than an order of magnitude below equipartition in this bit. We got very close to equipartition and we have an external radiation field, black body temperature of about 1500 Kelvin, some infrared radiation field, and then very close to equipartition. And also here, probably the best bit that we get is from a hadronic model where we are again just proton synchrotron not here. But again, rather modest energy requirements for the protons. Now, since we're in the session of variability modeling, let me just briefly summarize the work that I've done with Chuck Dermer some time ago about studies of variability in blazars. And so just to motivate what we've done here, so if we have an entire spectral energy distribution produced by one emission region, hadronic or leptonic, typically what you'd expect is that the entire SED would vary, maybe with some time delays due to radiative cooling or so, but you should see pretty much everything reasonably correlated. We see that often, but we see that sometimes not to be the case. This is the famous orphan TEV flare of 1ES1959, or we see not correlated flares, gamma ray flares not correlated with X-ray flares, for example, in 1510. Just as problematic is that we sometimes see in cross correlations between different energy bands, you expect from light travel time or cooling effects some consistent way in which you have either hard or soft lags between different bands. Correlations. We sometimes see cases here 3C4.13 where there seems to be a delay of gamma rays behind R band. Typically one expects the higher frequencies to come out before lower frequencies. See the hard lags is something you don't necessarily expect. Macquarie 421 is probably the weirdest of all because there sometimes we see hard lags, sometimes we see soft lags. Sometimes we see no lags. So the biggest problem here is if you have a simple one-zone synchrotron Compton or leptonic model, you expect some kind of consistent feature, which we often don't see. So in recent years, there has been a lot of developments on variability modeling, many of these models involving these internal shock models. So the basic idea is that we have probably not quite a steady source of relativistic plasma at the base of the jet, individual plasmoids interacting and leading to internal shocks. So basic assumptions, two different Lorentz factors, gamma A, gamma B, one shell catching up with the other one. Simplest assumption that we have some basic shock acceleration scenario that gives you a power law with some injection index. Then we can determine what lower and higher energy cutoff should be, the high energy cutoff. If we have some acceleration efficiency, some cooling efficiency, mostly from synchrotron, we can balance those, find a high energy cutoff in the injection spectrum. Gamma 1, low energy cutoff, just from the total energy normalization, assuming that we have the same amount of protons, the same number of protons as we have in electrons. So there's been a lot of numerical work done by these authors, including Manasvita, the most recent paper, on just a numerical solution of the radiation transfer and particle energization in these systems. What we've done is try to boil this down to as simple as possible expressions to have this been evaluated analytically as far as possible. First thing we've done is, so as we have two shocks, two plasmoids interacting, producing a shock, we have a forward and a reverse shock propagating through these two shells. At any given point within this merged shell, well, the shock has either not reached the point or it's past the point some time ago. So each time, each point in the emission region can be assigned a time since the shock has passed, which corresponds to a certain time that the electrons have had since injection and acceleration for cooling. And so we have this entire shock region with a very inhomogeneous distribution of electrons depending on how long it's been since the shock has passed any given point. So this cooling eventually will lead to a broken power law distribution from radiative cooling and escape and just the elapsed time, which will typically give you gamma to the minus 2 below the low energy cutoff, and at the high energy cutoff you expect this to be steepened by 1. The way we've treated this, so we have now included all light travel time effects. We have included the space and time dependent electron cooling. The synchrotron output, as we found, if we use a simple delta function approximation for synchrotron, can be calculated fully analytically. So at any given time, we can integrate analytically over the entire region and calculate what's the total emanating synchrotron spectrum at any given time. Essentially the same if we can treat the confidence scattering for the Thompson regime for the delta approximation fully analytically, so essentially no computer time required. The only thing that gets a little more messy is synchrotron self-Compton, because here we have different regions of the jet interacting with everything else at all different times, retarded times. That still requires two numerical integrations. But overall, any given set of parameters, we can produce a complete set of SEDs and light curves within just a few minutes. So it's a very fast and efficient way to calculate predictions of spectra and light curves from an internal shock model that we've developed. So here's just a little movie of the baseline model that we had assumed for a typical SED that corresponds to low-frequency blazars. So we had to restrict this analysis to objects, obviously, where we could reasonably assume that we can treat compton scattering in the Thompson regime, so the highest frequency peak blazars, we'd need to tweak our model a little bit, and we can probably not do that fully analytically anymore if we have to take the Klein-Yoshina effect seriously. We see that as long, so it's going to start over. The simulation starts essentially at the point of the time of contact, as the shock still propagates through both shells, particles keep being injected, the overall flux keeps increasing. You can see when these go back down, that's when the shocks actually break out of the original shells. We only have light travel time effects, electron cooling, and still synchrotron self-Compton interaction of different regions going on. We can just extract, say, over typical integration time scales, say, for a typical X-ray observation, and extract the overall SED, and we can extract light curves, because one has to keep in mind that that's not a realistic light curve of a more complicated scenario where you probably don't expect just one interaction to happen, probably expect several of these to be in a more or less rapid succession, but for one individual event, one individual collision, you expect just the phase here where you have ejection starting out, you have a propagation, and after breakout, you essentially are dominated by cooling events. So we've extracted light curves at typical optical energies here, X-rays, and a typical Fermi energy, so about 1 GeV. So you see the different light curves here for optical R-band. That's the 1 keV light curve X-ray, and we see this would be 1 GeV and with a Fermi energy range. A characteristic feature you see here is that for the X-rays, which are, as you can see, dominated by synchrotron self-Compton, that's produced in this setup by relatively low energy electrons that keep building up and they keep sticking around for quite a while, and due to light travel time effects, they'll have source photons to scatter for quite a long time. So you actually have a much smoother decay of these X-rays compared to all the other light curves that we see here. What we can do now is put these through the way that typically in observations one tests for time delays between different bands, and puts this through the free correlation function. When we do that, we find that we predict time lags in these in this internal shock model. In this case, we expect X-ray lag behind gamma rays about 1.5 hours, and we see, similar to what we've seen in 3C4.13, that we actually expect an optical lead before gamma rays, an optical lead before X-rays. Now we can see this was just one baseline model. We can see how this depends on the choice of parameters. That's the beauty of this model, that it's really very fast, just a few minutes to calculate different models, different model sets. We've done here, for example, change this external radiation field that can be used for Compton upscattering to change the total energy density, increasing to the right. I've plotted here is from these overall time integrated over 30 kilosecond SEVs, peak frequencies for synchrotron and Compton, and this is pretty much the blazar sequence as we know it, that as we go to higher external radiation energy densities that correspond very much to the traditional interpretation of the blazar sequence, you go from quasars, lower energy density, to IVLs, LVLs, and eventually going on to SSC-dominated high-frequency VLF objects. Down here, we have different fluxes. In particular, this brown curve here indicates Compton dominance. So if we go from VLX, quasars, as we actually see in the blazar sequence, we increase the Compton dominance. So that we can reproduce here. Let's see how these time lags depend on these parameters. So that's what we've got here, what I've shown here. The lower panel just shows the significance of the correlation between the different bands. This shows the time lags. This dashed curve shows optical versus 1 keV. You see consistently an optical lead before X-rays that diminishes as we go from the VLX towards the quasars. You see here 1 keV, the X-ray lag behind gamma rays, also decreasing with increasing external radiation field. But there's an interesting feature here that you see optical versus gamma rays, that with often just very slight changes in parameters, in the set's parameters, actually reverse the time lags, optical versus gamma rays. And we've done a larger parameter study in that paper. We found that there's actually quite a number of parameters where we see this funny effect that this change in the parameter slightly actually reverse the signs of these different lags. As we see, for example, in Macquarie 421, other objects, where we see no consistent trend of optical versus gamma ray or X-ray versus gamma ray lags. We see that this kind of model can actually explain these inconsistencies, can explain why we can't explain that, so to say. So a summary is, well, I've described basic features of leptonic models. I said that, well, this classical blazar sequence from HVLs to the quasars can be explained with increasing external Compton contribution, and I think Justin is going to elaborate on that a little bit more with new findings on the blazar sequence. We've seen that even intermediate VLX require external radiation fields. Maybe that indicates that that happens on relatively large time scales. And also the problem here, an interesting feature here, is that these are very high-energy gamma ray emitting objects that have to propagate through this external radiation field. So there's a possibility that there might be internal gamma-gamma absorption effects and maybe pair cascades coming out of that, and Parisa will talk about that tomorrow. I've shown that some very high-energy HBL disfavor pure synchrotron self-Compton models, either external Compton or hedonic models typically do a better job. I've described leptohedronic models and hadronic models, shown that they are often quite successful in describing at least SEDs, even though variability may be a problem in some of these models. And I've described basic results of the semi-analytical internal shock model, which we've used to predict time lags and interband correlations, and seen that changing time lags, changing signs of time lags, can be explained in this model. Just flash this while I'm taking questions. We have written a book on relativistic jets from AGN, which may be of interest, targeted towards grad students, young postdocs, or anybody who would like to get an up-to-date view of the field of relativistic jets. Three editors of this book is myself, Dan Harris, and Andrew Grabczynski. This should come out early next year. Thank you.
Time for one quick question.
So I take it that the reversing of the time lag in optical gamma ray is because the optical gamma ray electrons, the electrons that produce optical gamma ray are about the same energy, but as you tweak the parameters, sometimes the slightly higher energy that produces optical, sometimes slightly lower energy. Yeah. Is that right?
Yes.
What a good question, though.
All right, that was a quick question. All right, that was quick enough. We can do another one.
Yeah. And these were data with Veritas detections, which were typically bright Veritas states. So these show a moderate degree of variability. I think this corresponds to their state.
Okay, let's thank Marcus again.